morning, everybody. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the program the award-winning novelist Mohsin Hamid. His books have been international bestsellers, and they've been translated into more than 30 languages. Moth Smoke, his first novel, was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Prize. His second, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize and made into a movie in 2013. His third novel was the critically acclaimed bestseller How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. His new book, published yesterday, is a collection of essays written over the last 14 years while he was living in New York, London, and Lahore, Pakistan, the city of his birth, where he is now currently residing. It's called Discontents and Its Civilizations. Mohsin Hamid will be talking about the new essay collection Friday night at the Ivy Bookshop, and this morning he joins me on the line from New York. Good morning, Mohsin, and welcome back.
Good morning.
So these essays begin in 2000, about the time your first novel, Moth Smoke, was published. The world has changed a lot since 2000, and you write about what it was like to reread these essays, and you note that your view of the world has changed as well. How has it changed?
Well, it changes in different ways. So there was an essay that I wrote back in 2000 about applying for a visa at the Italian embassy in New York to see my Italian girlfriend at the time. And that seemed so much more innocent now. In a pre-9/11 world, getting a little bit hassled for having a, you know, Muslim-sounding name. Looking back at it, of course, I could see the world was going to change a few months after that. And those kind of occurrences keep cropping up where things we don't know are going to happen later do happen.
You've divided the collection into three sections, the first about life, essays about life, the second section about art, and the last about politics. How would you describe the difference in the tone and the nature of the public discourse in the United States and Great Britain and Pakistan, where you wrote all of these essays at various times? And how did that inform you, those differences, if they exist? How did they inform what you were writing from each of those countries? Do you have a different view of the world depending on the perch from which you're looking at it?
I think if you move around, as I have, and I've lived about 17 years of my life in the U.S. and almost a decade in the U.K. and the rest in Pakistan, each place does have, in a way, a different culture, media culture, the way people tend to express themselves in newspapers and magazines and television. But that said, there are lots of exceptions in all three places. So you have places in America where people have perhaps considerable knowledge of Pakistan or a very open-minded cosmopolitan attitude. Similarly, in Pakistan, there are places where you'll encounter quite strong anti-Americanism. But in others, you'll find real affection for America. So I guess traveling around and writing and communicating in different places, what I've come to realize is that people are different. They're not uniform in any one country. And those differences, in fact, I think unite us.
So you note that you lived in New York just before the 9/11 attacks. You were in London at the time of the subway bombings there in 2005. And then you've been in Pakistan over these last few years as the incidence of terrorist activity has increased there. You write at one point that this entire collection can be read as the experience of a man caught in the middle of this ongoing terrorism. What is Pakistan's place in this climate and in this fight against extremism as you see it now?
Well, I think Pakistan is very important in a number of different ways. One, of course, there are a number of extremist groups that originate in Pakistan, and that's a concern for Pakistanis because those extremists mostly kill Pakistanis. But it's a concern for the whole world because those people also kill Americans and Europeans and people in other places. At the same time, Pakistan is a very diverse society. So you have many different languages, many different religious sects. And in a place like Pakistan, if you can find a way for different types of people to live together peacefully, that's hugely important. It's important because it advances a kind of pluralism that our world needs. And it's important because it reduces the threat that Pakistan poses to itself and to others.
Mohsin Hamid, his new book is a collection of essays called Discontents and Its Civilizations. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. the day of the Charlie Hebdo murders, there were 37 police cadets in Yemen who were murdered. And just a few weeks before the incident in Paris, there were 130 children gunned down by militants in Pakistan at an army-operated public school. You write that Pakistan is at the forefront of the escalating conflicts between Sunni and Shia Muslims. That's interesting. I think a lot of folks would assume that the forefront isn't actually in Pakistan or Afghanistan, but it's places like Iraq and Syria or, you know, Israel and Palestine, those kinds of places. But because the diversity of the Muslim population in Pakistan is so wildly diverse, do you think this puts it in the forefront of this very serious rift?
Well, I think that when I was growing up, I didn't even know which of my friends were Shia or Sunni. It wasn't really something anybody cared about. And today, I have friends who, you know, are Shia who've had family members assassinated or who've left the country because of threats. So there's been a real change. And Pakistan has one of the largest Shia populations in the world. Because Pakistan is such a big country, population-wise, almost 200 million people, the Shia population of Pakistan is much bigger than pretty much any country except for Iran. So what happens to Pakistan's Shias is very important at a human level, but also because there are so many Shias in Pakistan, it's vital that Pakistan finds a way to accommodate them.
And you say that this conflict really will not end. The key to it is for Pakistan to find peace with India. How is that possible, and what's going to change if that wonderful dream is realized?
Well, I think, in a way, not that much needs to change. The Indo-Pak conflict, to my eyes, isn't really that difficult to resolve. There's only one main dispute, and that's over Kashmir. And Kashmir is a province that's divided between India and Pakistan at the moment. Both sides claim it, and they fight over it. But surely there's a way to say that, you know, what's the best situation for the Kashmiris themselves? You know, perhaps you can leave the border where it is, but allow the Kashmiris more autonomy inside of separately Pakistan and India, allow them to move freely between the two parts, and Kashmir can become a bridge between India and Pakistan. I don't think it's as difficult a problem to resolve as Israel-Palestine, for example, where both sides claim the same land for their entire countries. And that said, there are really strong constituencies on both sides, India and Pakistan, that don't want to see this problem resolved, that support a kind of nationalistic chauvinism. And that's why it isn't being solved.
You write that at the heart of the trouble in Pakistan is what you refer to as the celebration of the militant. There's still enough people in Pakistan elevating the radical contingents. But you also write that it's really only about 10% of the population actually voting for political parties that are far to the right. How do those two things square?
Well, the religious right parties get a tiny share of Pakistan's vote in the elections, less than 10%, often less than 5%. And even those who vote for parties on the religious right don't necessarily support extremists because those parties have wings that aren't militant, obviously. So it's only a tiny percentage, 1%, maybe less than that, who actually support these extremist groups in Pakistan. But that said, Pakistan has been its own worst enemy. The Pakistani state, for many decades, has backed extremists, used them as proxies, you know, against India in Afghanistan, and along with the U.S., developed them, you know, to fight the Soviets in the 1980s. Those policies have been a catastrophic mistake, and Pakistan has to now recognize that there's no such thing as a good militant or a bad militant. All militants are deadly to Pakistanis. And the country has to come to a decision that it's going to really stop supporting them and, in fact, when necessary, fight them.
So you write a lot about what you think the solutions within Pakistan can be. You also write a lot about the U.S. and what the U.S. can do. You say at one point that the prevailing Western discourse about Pakistan and Afghanistan is simplistic and dehumanizing. You write a great deal in this collection about drones and the effects that drones have on the internal politics of Pakistan. What do most Americans get wrong about Pakistan and about what our role can be to lift the country up?
Well, I think most Americans are probably quite baffled by Pakistan. It's very hard to figure out what's going on there, what America should do. But the drone war, I think, has been a big mistake, because Pakistan is such a large country. Its population is, you know, two-thirds that of the United States. It's a huge country population-wise, much more than Iraq or Afghanistan put together. In fact, almost three times as much as those two countries put together. So Pakistan has to police itself. It has to take care of its own problems. And the drone war in Pakistan has allowed many Pakistanis to blame the U.S., to say, well, this is a U.S. intervention, and these extremists are fighting America. It's not our fight. And that is a disaster. So the drones might kill a few militants, but they make it much more difficult for Pakistani society to get together around the idea of stopping the militants entirely. And that, I think, has backfired on the U.S. and on Pakistan as well.
The title of this collection is Discontent and Its Civilizations. You write that civilizations are illusions, but these illusions are persuasive and useful. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, when we look closely at a civilization, for example, you know, a Muslim civilization or a Western civilization, American civilization, when we look at the people who make up that civilization, who live in that civilization, they're very diverse. So in Pakistan, you have people who might be gay or atheists or very liberal or, you know, women prime ministers. And these don't really fit the notion of what a Muslim civilization's inhabitants would look like. And of course, in America, you might have plenty of Muslims living here and praying five times a day, and they're Americans. So the two societies or civilizations actually really blur when you start looking at them closely. I think that we kind of make up this idea that we belong to civilizations, because it's a way for us to justify the conflicts that we have. In Pakistan, the problem is really, you know, that people don't have a decent education, clean drinking water, enough food, housing. And then they're told that, no, the Muslim civilization is under threat and you must, you know, fight to protect the Muslim civilization. It's a distraction from the real problems of the people. And I think the same is true in the United States, where America wages so many wars abroad. But really, those are just distractions from the real work that has to be done in America to help Americans.
Well, I enjoyed this entire collection. In particular, I enjoyed the political observations you had and your writing about the endeavor of writing. And you say that novels are co-creations of both the writer and the reader. And you say that co-creation is central to your politics as well. In what way? How so?
Well, when you read a book, you're just looking at words on a page, but somehow you imagine what these characters look like, what they sound like, and what the world feels like. That's the creation of the reader. And that's why when you watch a movie adapted from a book, two readers will never agree on whether or not the main character looks like what they imagined the main character would look like, because they had different creations in their own minds. And I think novels give readers that power to create their own stories. And our politics is similar. It's not my attempt to tell people, look, you know, I'm right, follow me, do what I do, and believe what I believe. What I'm trying to do is to say that together we shape our societies. It's a project that we all collectively engage in. So let's not accept what other people are telling us about the way things must be. Let's be proactive and imagine what we'd like them to be.
Mohsen Hamid, he's joined us on the line from New York. Thanks to our friends at the Argo Studios for helping with that. His new collection of essays is called Discontents and Its Civilizations, Dispatches from Lahore, New York, and London. It's published by Riverhead Books. Mohsen Hamid will be appearing at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road in North Baltimore Friday night, 7 o'clock. We've got all the details on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Mohsen Hamid, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks again.
It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Stick around. Coming up next, The Environment in Focus.